If you desire to follow along, I'll have you turn to Hebrews chapter 11 this morning. Hebrews chapter 11, as we continue in the book of Hebrews. As we have been reading, studying, learning from the book of Hebrews, we have seen chapter after chapter, subject after subject, Christ set forth in all his fullness and excellency as the mediator of a new covenant, as the great high priest of God's people. And we have seen how, in all respects, that the covenant that he mediates, the kingdom which he rules, and the priest himself is greater than all of those things that were types and shadows pointing to it. And now as we have come to the 11th chapter, we begin to see how this life of faith of God's people is set before us, example after example, demonstrated for us, illustrated for us, something that can be defined, but something that if we are to understand it in our souls, God gives us examples to look at, illustrations of this, so that we can understand it, so that we can understand it in an intimate way. Because this is the life of faith that God calls his people to have intimate acquaintance with him. He that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And the greatest reward of all, the greatest treasure that we can obtain is to know God himself, is to have him for our God, him for our inheritance and our possession. This is what Abraham and Moses and others sought for. This is what they desired. This is what they pursued with all their heart and with all their soul. This is what they were willing to cast off earthly things in favor of. And so now, as we continue in Hebrews chapter 11, we continue in the life of Abraham. And I will begin reading this morning in chapter 11, verse 13, a little overlap with what we've read already, and continue until the 19th verse. Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. What are the most important things in your life? What are the most important things? There are many things that we place importance on. For some people, it's a kind of achievement. It's an attainment in a career. It's to have a certain level of respect and accomplishment. That is the driving motivation in their life. The thing that is most important. The thing that they cannot live without. The thing that without which they'll never be happy in life. Never be satisfied. For some people, it's wealth, having great possessions, the thing that gives them comfort. You know, it says that the love of money is the root of all evil. Why is that? What is it about money? What is it about treasure that can become so opposed to the ways of God? I think part of it is because it is something that we can find our sufficiency in. We can find our comfort in. If we have all the abundance that we need, then we can trust in those things. We can be secure in those things. We can be secure in the knowledge that the experiences and the pleasures that we desire, that give our life meaning, that we can purchase them. We can obtain them at any moment that we desire. And so some put great importance in their wealth and their earthly treasures. For some, it's people. For some, it's their children or their spouse that is the most important. Well, here we are given this example of Abraham and how that in faith, Abraham offered up as a sacrifice his only begotten son. Now this example of Abraham, this event that happened in Abraham, is a unique and special event in the history of God's people. It's not something that God will ever again call one of his children to do, to sacrifice on the altar their child. But for a very particular reason and at a very particular time, this was the trial to which God put Abraham. Now Abraham was someone who God clearly loved, who God clearly desired to bless abundantly. Think about the promises that were promised to Abraham. These promises were promises that the people of God, they looked back on generation after generation, and they saw in Abraham, they saw in him signified all the promises of God, because God called out Abraham and he promised to bless him, and he said that he would bless him, and that he would bless those that bless him, that he would curse those that curse him. He said in him all the families of the earth would be blessed. That not only would Abraham be blessed, but he would be an instrument through which the blessings of God would flow out into all the nations of the world. The blessings of Abraham were global in scope. They were so vast. He told Abraham that his descendants would be as the sand of the sea, as the stars in heavens. And so it is not without reason that generation after generation, God's people would look back and they would see in Abraham. They would see him as the father of the faithful. They would see him as special in the purpose and the plan of God. Surely God's love for Abraham was vast and great. He was the heir of so many blessings. And yet Abraham was called by God to something so agonizing, so torturous to his soul. Hebrew literature, Hebrew writing is, I think, marked by many things, but one of the things is the degree of understatement to which we see in it. I mean, when it describes the events that lead up to Abraham sacrificing Isaac, it doesn't spend three chapters speaking about how he went off by himself agonizing over this decision, agonizing over whether or not he could endure this, whether or not his soul could bear the loss of his only begotten son. It doesn't spend this time agonizing over how the reasoning in his mind went, how he came to the conclusion that it describes here, that he trusted that God could even raise the dead. But it does say something that speaks to the difficulty of which Abraham had. It said that he loved his son. And as it describes it here, it says that by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. With Abraham, the trial cut deep. Let me ask you a question. A question that requires self-examination. A question that you probably can't answer sitting here in the pew right now, but that I ask you to consider. Are you willing to suffer the loss of all things for the sake of gaining fellowship with God? Are you willing to lose everything? Because this is the only way in which we can obtain in which we can move forward in fellowship with God. Nothing must stand in its way. Nothing must come before God in our hearts. It says, set your affections on things above, not on things of the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. We have as our possession, as our inheritance, the greatest thing of all. We have life with God. And we are called. We are called by the words of Christ himself. When he walked this earth and he spoke to his disciples, we are called to suffer the loss of all things. We are called to leave behind our life, even our very life, even our very self, to gain life with him. Think of the words Jesus said. Listen to these words that Jesus said. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, then said Jesus unto his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. This is what it means to follow Jesus. To deny self. To deny ourself. This is both the most blessed and glorious thing that we could do. It is also the most difficult. Because ever since the very beginning, ever since sin entered the world, we have been in love with self. More than God. That is the battle. That we love ourselves. That we seek to exalt ourselves. That we seek to please ourselves. That we seek to serve that self-love. And Jesus cuts to the very heart. Just like God cut deep with Abraham. It wasn't enough for God. Because of God's great love for Abraham, it wasn't enough for him to call Abraham to give up, to offer up something small. It wasn't enough for God to try him with the little things, but he cut him deep because he had in store for Abraham an exceeding great reward. It says, God is not ashamed to be called their God. God is not ashamed to be called our God. He says, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. The cross is the instrument of death, an instrument of execution. To take up our cross, to take up a cross is to be willing to put to death our life, our desires, to lay them at the feet of God. To sacrifice them to him. He says, for whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? There is a question. There is a question that pierces to the heart of man. In every age, in every time, in every place, every circumstance, every culture, this question comes with great power. This rhetorical question that Jesus asks. Whatever it is that is the driving desire of your life, if you were to have it all, if you were to obtain every bit of what you desire, security, safety, achievement, honor, respect, wealth. If you were to gain the whole world and to lose your soul, what gain is there? than that? What profit if a man shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? God gives something of far more value, far more treasure. The things of God are of eternal worth. We've already seen how Abraham was willing to leave behind a city of great wealth and great glory, leave behind the comforts of home to go and to be a stranger and a pilgrim. Why? Because it says he sought a city whose builder and maker was God. He was already on the path, living his life for the things that are unseen, the things that are eternal, the things that are heavenly. He was being trained by God. He was learning in the school of leaving behind the tangible, touchable things, the seen things, so that he could fix the eye of faith upon heavenly treasures. And this was what God was teaching him all along. Trial after trial, test after test, showing him that he would live by promise. He would live by promise and not by sight. So God tested him to the full degree. He waited. God waited because God desired Abraham to learn through that experience. He waited until he was of great age before Abraham was able to lay his hands on the fulfillment of God's promise that God would give him a seed through which all the nations of the world would be blessed. And we are told later, we are given to see the fulfillment of that seed speaks of the one who would come from that line. Jesus Christ himself was the promised seed. It was Jesus himself through whom all the nations of the world would be blessed. And Abraham was suffered by God to wait for many years to see the fulfillment of that. And when he saw it, when he laid his hands on it, he was able to laugh for joy at the fullness of God's promises and their fulfillment. And Isaac was the pleasure of his heart. In Isaac, he saw the promises of God being fulfilled, and God tested him in that as well. We see here also in this passage, we see how, though faith transcends our reason, and yet faith is not unreasonable. Faith is not without logic, without reason, and yet it transcends it so far as the heaven is above the earth. The chapter began by saying of faith that it's the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And that emphasis on the unseen is brought to our attention again and again and again. Our emphasis on the emphasis of faith on the unseen. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And so faith goes beyond our limited human logic and reasoning. You know, we have been shown something by God that goes beyond merely an inference. You know, it's possible to reason to the conclusion of the truth of God. Man can observe in the creation that God has made that there is a great wisdom, a great power, and a great character that must be behind the glories of the creation all around us that we can see with our eyes and we can touch with our hands. But the greatness of the knowledge of God in the life of the Christian is not merely an inference. It's not merely a logical conclusion, because God is a personal being. God is someone that is not just known about, but someone that is known by personal experience. And every Christian who has been born again by the glorious Spirit of God knows God intimately and has a capacity to have fellowship and communication and communion with God and a knowledge of God's presence. God's presence, which is everywhere. So that if we were to ascend up to the heights of heaven or descend into the depths of the earth, we would not be distant from the very presence of God. For He is everywhere present and nowhere absent. As it says, in Him we live and move and have our being, and He is not far from every one of us. But we see how faith also brings about a restoration of true reason, of true understanding and logic. So that it says, by faith we understand that the worlds were made by the word of God. And by faith, Abraham was able to reason that this God who he knew intimately, this God was able even to raise up the dead. And Abraham could see that in God's works all around him. Abraham, when he heard his ancestors tell him the story of how one time when wickedness was so full in all the earth that God came and judged the world with a flood, and all creatures died, and the earth itself was destroyed, and the world that then was perished, being overflowed with water, Abraham could hear about how God, by his saving power, brought through that flood the living creatures, and he preserved them, and he caused them to grow and to flourish once again and fill the earth and subdue it, and how God brought from that death, he brought new life into the earth. Abraham could hear and know about a God who was able to bring life out of death. Abraham had seen how God had brought his nephew Lot out of the destruction of Sodom and brought new life and deliverance and salvation for Lot out of death. And he knew that God was a God who had all power. God who was a God that was able to raise from his bride's dead womb new life and bring Isaac into life. And if God could do it, if God could deliver his people and work glorious things time and again, this God, and if this God had promised that through Isaac his seed would be called, then Abraham reasoned that this God is able, even if I must slay Isaac on that altar, even if the knife must cut deep, that God is able to raise him up from the dead. And it says that Abraham did in fact receive Isaac back from the dead. Because we see from these things that Abraham was fully persuaded in his faith to do that which God had called him to do, knowing and trusting that God was able to raise up his only begotten son. Accounting, it says that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. And so now when Abraham received Isaac back, he received him in newness of life. Whatever the dynamics, whatever the nature of the relationship that Abraham had with Isaac before, and what a glorious relationship it was with father and son. Whatever the nature of it was before, it was forever changed, forever transformed. Because they had passed through the fire of willingness. Willingness to give up all things for the sake of gaining God. Abraham was willing to even give up Isaac. Isaac himself walked willingly up the hill, up the mountain, to the altar. He carried the wood of his sacrifice on his own back, and he walked up. By this time, Isaac was a young man strong enough to carry that wood. Perhaps, and we don't know, perhaps even strong enough, if he wished, to overpower his father. But Isaac walked willingly, and he asked his father, as they went up, he said, "Father, we have the wood, we have the fire, we have everything we need to make the sacrifice, but where is the lamb for the sacrifice? Where is the offering? And Abraham said to his son, he said, son, God will provide himself a sacrifice. God would provide that which was sacrificed. Isaac himself, standing there before the view of Abraham, Isaac himself was the very gift of God. A miracle child. One who came as a living, walking demonstration of the power and faithfulness of God. And as Abraham looked into his eyes, he could see that the God who did this, he would provide. He would provide. And if it took God performing the miracle of bringing Isaac back from the dead, he could do it. And they walked up the hill, and Isaac was laid upon the altar, tied to that altar. And Abraham prepared to slay the sacrifice. But God sent his angel to stop him. And as Abraham looked around, he saw an animal caught in the thicket. He saw that God had provided, in Isaac's place, he provided a substitute. A substitutionary sacrifice that could be offered in the place of this man. We see in these things that God has provided a figure. That we, through that, might see by faith what God would later do. When God would not call Abraham or Moses, or any other man to go and take his son and offer it upon the altar. But he so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And his son carried the wood of his sacrifice and he carried it up the hill. But this time, though Jesus said if he wished, he could call and 12 legions of angels would come. This time, God didn't send the angel to stop the driving of the nails or the placing of the crown of thorns. He didn't send his angels to stop the soldiers from mocking him or from dividing his clothes by lots. But Jesus went like a sheep. It says he was silent. Jesus didn't raise some great argument to defend himself, though he had every possible reason to demonstrate and to prove, though he had time and again, by his reason and his divine wisdom, put the Pharisees and the Sadducees to silence and to shame with the wisdom of his words. Yet this time, he said nothing to defend himself. And he went willingly. And he offered himself there as a sacrifice. This time, no lamb or goat was found caught in the thicket to be offered as a substitute, because he himself was the substitute. He himself. When a murderer went free. When adulterers and murderers and the proud and the covetous went free. When you and I went free, our substitute hung there, bleeding and dying in our place. He who, of whom it was said at his baptism, and a voice from heaven, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." There is no one that the Father could look upon with more pleasure than his Son. But because of the great love wherewith he loved us, he was willing to give his Son. And God also knew. In fulfillment of his promise and his righteousness, and in demonstration of his great power and his victory over Satan and all his evils and over the power of sin entered into the world, that he was able and willing to raise him up from the dead on the third day. And though Isaac didn't have to go down into the grave, though his blood was not shed that day, though he was not buried and put in the grave for 3 days and three nights, yet Jesus was. And yet death was not able to hold him. Him who is the Prince of Life, him who is the source of all life, him of whom it is said that all things were created by him, and without him was nothing made that was made. Death could not hold him. The grave could not contain him. But he victoriously over death rose again the third day for our justification. And when we see the length to which God is willing to go in his love, how is it, we might ask ourselves, how is it that we might hang on to anything and let anything rise above the love of God in our hearts? God does not take from us everything. I venture to say that none of us will suffer the loss that one such as Job suffered. But I do desire that we would have the same attitude of heart that even Job had, when God had taken from him so much. And he was able to say, the Lord gives, and the Lord takes. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Because even if we do suffer the loss of so much, if we have God, we have everything of value. We have everything. And God is able to give us what we need and so far beyond. What profiteth a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And so may we, like the saints of old, like the examples that are set before us, may we diligently seek God, knowing that at the end of that seeking, there is no disappointment. There is no letdown like there is with seeking earthly things, even good things of this earth. If we set our hearts on them as our greatest desire, we will find that they fall short of fulfilling the greatest need. For we have been created in the image of God, and we have been created for him and for his pleasure. All things were created by him. And this we acknowledge. This we acknowledge as a tenet of our faith, that God is the creator of all things, but all things were created by him, and all things were created for him. And so we exist as his treasure and his possession. We exist for the pleasure of God, and unless we are living for that end and that purpose, we will never find our true satisfaction and purpose in this life. So let us seek him, knowing that the end of that seeking, at the end of that seeking, is the greatest treasure of all, to know God, to draw nearer and closer to him who is worthy of that seeking, worthy of the giving up of anything that he calls us to give up, that we might gain that which is of eternal value.